I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. They are the Janjaweed, killing and raping in Sudan with impunity. They are the rebels of Chechnya, stringing explosives over the heads of school children. And they are the agents of Al-Qaeda, posting anonymous video clips of hostages and beheadings on the internet. The Nigerian-born writer, Wole Soyinka, says they are a new generation of stateless fanatics, sometimes driven by religion, sometimes not, but all, in the end, using the same weapon, fear. When the Nobel Committee awarded Soyinka the prize for literature, it praised his, quote, wide cultural perspective, his poetic overtones fashioning the drama of existence. Well, for nearly 50 years, Soyinka has aimed his own spotlight of respectability at the abuses of power. He joins us today to talk about what he calls this new climate of fear and how it's being created by terrorists and exploited by political and religious leaders. Do you see a new politics of fear at work in the world? How much of that is real? How much of it is turned to political gain? Soyinka recommends a powerful embrace of equality and humanism as a means to stop terrorism. He also says that religious leaders need to speak out more against crimes committed in the name of God. Do you agree with that? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, Wole Soyinka began his literary career as a playwright. He's also a poet and a novelist, and as I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, a political activist. He spent 2 years in solitary confinement during Nigeria's civil war. At this hour, he is in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, for a reading of his poem, Samarkand, and we will be connecting with him in just a couple of moments. We're having some technical difficulties. It gives me actually a chance to take us back about 20 years to the time when Soyinka was awarded his Nobel Prize, because he began by speaking to the people there about an experience that he had been through as an actor and a playwright on a stage in London when they were reenacting a particularly nasty part of African history when detainees were beaten to death at the Hola camp in Kenya. And it's a story that he kind of backs into slowly, because what he wants to do is remind people that when you're up on stage and doing a reenactment of something that is real and is so violent, there's often some reluctance to take part in that. Let's listen to the voice of Wole Soyinka. This was recorded in 1986 as he received his Nobel Prize for Literature.
An actor refused to come on stage for his allocated role. Action was suspended. A fellow actor tried to persuade him to emerge, but he stubbornly shook his head. Then a struggle ensued. The second actor had hoped that by suddenly exposing the reluctant actor to the audience in full glare of the spotlight, he would have no choice but to rejoin the cast. And so he tried to take the delinquent actor by surprise, pulling him suddenly towards the stage. He didn't fully succeed, so a brief but untidy struggle began. The unwilling actor was completely taken aback and deeply embarrassed. Some of that tussle had been quite visible to parts of the audience.
That's the voice of Wole Soyinka talking to the, as he received his Nobel Prize for Literature. As I said, he's joining us now on the line from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. It's good to have you with us. Welcome to The Connection.
Disconnected now.
Ah, we've got you now on the line. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, I can hear you distinctly.
Okay, terrific. That's great. I wanted to start square on with your recent writing about this new climate of fear in America, in part because I'm wondering if we watch this every day in the news. We had the story from Iraq yesterday of some 120 people killed by their own colleagues in a car bombing, which has been barely explained, but one of the worst atrocities since that war began. Is that a part of what you're talking about?
No, I wasn't talking specifically of Iraq, but it is indeed, in general terms, that. The breaching of hitherto unthinkable lines, the rapidity with which these atrocities occur, almost irrespective of who the victims are.
When you say breaching of lines that we would not have thought would be crossed in times past, I want to go back for a checklist, and I know that you've done this, so help me with this. You personally have seen the atrocities of colonial times in your home country of Nigeria. and what Hitler did in the Second World War, and the fear that we all lived with during the Cold War. Are you saying that there was a certain, I don't know, diplomacy or dignity to those confrontations which has been changed now?
No, not in the slightest. The Hitlerian period you're talking about was specific over a number of years. The world refused to believe, for instance, that these things were going on, despite all reports, or maybe just preferred not to believe it. And eventually, remember this, it led to war. And once war started, the issues were very, very clear. In other words, those atrocities were basically secret, almost kind of furtive atrocities, even though they were conducted on such a large scale. What we're seeing today is open and boastful and very indiscriminate in the kind of victims it selects.
When you talk about the people who are taking part in these kind of atrocities, are these the ones who fall under the umbrella that you describe as the quasi-state?
Yes, the quasi-state, very definitely. It's now, I was going to use the word fashionable. Let us just say that there is a growing tendency among the insurgents of the world, if you like, the oppositional, the alternatives of the world, those who profile a very different worldview, very different religion. There is now a tendency to actually assume the authority of states. Yes, these are the quasi-states.
And I'm wondering if, in your view, something is changing. I know Iraq is not the example that you use to describe this, but if we can stay with it, because it's in the news, it's in people's minds on this morning. It struck me that yesterday, when so many people were killed in a bomb, which we have to believe was, you know, set and detonated by another Iraqi, that the scale of the killing seems to have almost lost some of the political notions that were a part of the original attacks. I mean, we had to believe early on in the war that there were insurgents attacking their own people simply to make the point that the invasion was a bad idea, that the Americans weren't able to offer any safety and security. And now, with that scale of death, 120 people, another dozen today, a judge gunned down this morning, it almost seems like those lives have even less meaning.
Yes, you're right. We're facing, in Iraq specifically, a very new, comparatively speaking, of course, kind of terror. And we're looking, if you like, in the face of evil. First of all, let me agree with you that the scale of these murders was simply mind-boggling and really shocking. But I'm more interested, in fact, in the crossing of lines, such as, if you leave the quantity alone, take a look at the elimination of places we used to consider sacrosanct, like mosques and churches, the infant creche. I'm more horrified, in fact, by the attack on during the Shiite festival. I'm more concerned with that. The fact that these attacks are deliberately targeted at human beings at the moment of their spiritual devotion. It is this which is really horrifying, far more than the actual number of victims.
And you use the phrase, too, I think, with some anger, or repeat the phrase, there are no innocents, as a way of making that point. I think now of a passage where you were writing about the attack on the school children in Beslan.
Yes, well, quite frankly, I hate to use metaphysical expressions in situations of this kind, which are so palpable and so humanly affective. But I get the feeling sometimes that we're the word evil is coming back into reckoning. When human beings, you know, adult, as I say in my book, grizzled war veterans make children their target for any purpose whatsoever, not allowed even their period of innocence, which is not all that much in a whole lifespan, and victimize and traumatize children, I reach for words and I find there's only one left in my vocabulary, and that's evil. I'm afraid the theologians are going to win this battle in the end.
And And I know you've spent time thinking about this. Have you figured out what's happening here? Why people are crossing that line, or why people either believe they can or are being allowed to cross these lines?
Well, I speak also of the phenomenon of power, the claim to power of the powerless, and then the powerless become the tyrannical. It's a process which we've seen repeated over and over again in the course of history, revolutionary wars in which the original causes might be considered just, but then the original cause is lost in the sheer luxuriation of power. You know, the powerless become suddenly powerful and they pick victims who are less powerful than they are. This is the phenomenon which we are watching today, which we saw in Beslan, which we're watching in Iraq. Although the Iraq, again, I must pick a small exception there, because those who are committing these atrocities are actually those who suddenly find themselves powerless. I mean, before they lorded it over the rest of the country, they cannot get used to being deprived of this preferential existence under Saddam Hussein, and they're no longer fighting the Americans. They are really seeking to regain power. At the bottom of it, you have this phenomenon of an attachment to power, no matter what it takes.
Connection listeners, when we come back, more on that from the Nobel laureate Wole Soyinka. The use and the observance of evil in the world, is it really as simple, as horrible as that? Your thoughts on the lines that are being crossed that we're talking about on the program here. 1-800-423-8255. That's the number to join us. And where are the politicians? Where are the religious leaders in this? Where are their responsibilities? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. My guest this hour is Wole Soyinka. He is a Nigerian-born writer who was imprisoned back in the mid-60s for speaking out against the government. He won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1986, and he's collected a number of his recent lectures and into a new book. It's called Climate of Fear, The Quest for Dignity in a Dehumanized World. I know that some of your early plays from before you were in jail, dealt specifically with Africans and their attempt to fight against these abuses of power that we're talking about. Would it be fair to say, that the rest of the world is now beginning to learn what people in places like Nigeria and Uganda and the Congo have seen for generations?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. Not that it's new to them. I'm glad you made that reference to the period of Hitler. This is a horror which was unleashed on an unsuspecting world. But that now tends to almost have been dematerialized, even though occasionally there are reminders. But now, so that when kind of massacres took place in Rwanda, occurs
in orphanages and in churches again.
Even some of the organizers were priests, you know, Christian priests, who've been sentenced today in the courts for abuses of human rights, etc., etc. Right. People all over the world have no reference point. That is why today Madrid takes people by surprise. What is happening in Iraq is mind-boggling to many, many people, but there are historical references all the time.
Do you see in Darfur today the same kind of crossing of lines?
Mm-hmm. Yes, although here there's a very strong dose of racism. These are people who consider their victims as less than human and virtually want to wipe out their racial identity by committing mass rape. I mean, they pronounce it as one of their goals, and then killing off the adults, the women, male, and so on. It's again, history, I'm afraid, has a grotesque way of repeating itself with variations.
Well, and there's a fair amount of racism in that history, too, in the way that people regard various tragedies. I mean, you go back to the killing of, I don't know how many hundreds of people died in that absurd moment when Nigeria decided that it didn't want to hold the Miss World.
Yes, fanaticism crosses. As I say in that book, there are many, many strains of Christianity, many strains of Islam, many strains of Judaic religion. But there is also a separate strain which unites all of them, and that is the fanatic strain. It doesn't know any religion, although religion can be the triggering force. Even secular ideology breeds fanatics, and fanatics despise the rest of humanity.
If I read your book correctly, though, you say that the fanatics who come at it from religion are a great deal more dangerous because there's less room for reason in that conversation. Did I get that part right?
Yes, absolutely right. The religious fanatic is the worst infliction that the world has known historically.
So you can debate Castro, despite the fact that he would stand up there and talk about his idea of the world for 2.5 hours, whereas you can't debate Ayatollah Khomeini or people like that?
That's correct. You can debate secular ideology. It takes its roots from the material world. In fact, its theories are derived, well, so it says, but very often it gets to a kind of theological level where irrationality sets in. But at base, secular ideology is an attempt to analyze and to prospect for the future of our material world, with the spiritual. The so-called religionists, they think they're on direct line to God Almighty, wherever he is, and obey only those they recognize as his intermediaries.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Wole Soyinka is with me this hour. We're talking about what he describes as a new climate of fear in the world, fueled, as we're talking, by this kind of religious fanaticism. We're also talking about what needs to be done now. Let's go to Norfolk, Virginia for our first call. And Richard's with us. Hi, Richard.
Hi, thank you. My question has to do with the lack of moral leadership for religious leaders throughout the world. It seems strange that politicians of opposite orientations can sit down and negotiate and join forces, while religious leaders, who possibly are too firmly entrenched to their own faiths, seem unable to do so. While they are supposedly the moral leaders of the world, they cannot speak out against certain of them who are even trying to enlist young people to become terrorists. How is it that internationally, moral leaders, the religious leaders of the world, cannot join forces?
Let me remind you also that politicians sometimes are the promoters of atrocities, which then take on religious overtones. In other words, and I give my own society as an example, the politicians foment political violence by resorting to religious instincts, and sometimes by their very policies, their very political activities. The United States is an example, for instance. The United States is a very large contributory factor, or rather, more accurately, the government of the United States has been a very important contributory factor to the climate of fear and to the growth of terrorism in the world, simply because of its policies. So I don't want us to lay the blame or the share responsibility. We don't want to give the major share to the failures of the religious leaders. There is a kind of collaboration of guilt in this. But I agree with you that the religious leaders have a responsibility which they've shirked considerably.
I was on an airplane internationally and sitting next to a clergyman from Iran, actually, who and I asked him, how is it that religious leaders cannot speak out? And he gave me a simple answer. He said, they're afraid to do so. And I wonder whether this might be the case that prevents them from speaking out.
No, I think there's a moral lack. There are instances, let's face it, there are instances. This is why I try very hard not to generalize too much. The situation in Iraq today is very volatile, and it's very different from what's happening in Darfur. It's different from what happened in Rwanda. So in some cases, yes, religious leaders. In Rwanda, for instance, any moderate was considered as guilty as the Tutsis and was wiped out, whatever his religion. So there are instances like that. But overall, I would say that religious leaders have accumulated so much respect from their followership that they have a certain authority that they're not wielding, or rather, which they wield in the wrong direction.
I want to go back to the first part of your answer to Richard's question about the American government's, this U.S. administration's use of language, or sort of promotion of this kind of religious divisiveness. Give me an example of specifically what you mean.
Well, first of all, the political action of the present government, the very invasion of Iraq, which could not be justified, at least not along the lines that were claimed as the reason for going in there. Now, this united the Islamic world in a way in which it was not before. It created an instant army that could be recruited in the cause of religious confrontation, religious intolerance.
But are you implying that it was done intentionally?
What do you mean? I don't understand. You mean the invasion of Iraq?
No, the uniting of the are you saying that?
Oh, no. I don't think for a single moment that George Bush or any member of his government intended to unite the Islamic world against the rest, if you like, or against Christendom. I ignore completely the, you know, there was a lot of, you recollect, there was a lot of furore over the use of the word crusade by George Bush. No, I'm not talking about that. Crusade is just an ordinary word these days. I mean, Rav Nader was called a crusader for consumers.
You can have secular crusaders as well.
Yes, secular crusaders. No, that didn't bother me at all. I think people overdid that aspect of George Bush's vocabulary. No, I am talking about the policy, the invasion of Iraq without international support, without the authority of the United Nations, in fact, over the opposition of the organization which is supposed to represent the whole world. And so that part of the world is united on this particular issue, and sometimes the governments turn, look the other way when terrorists are being recruited right amongst them, because there is a greater, quote-unquote, greater cause which unites that world, and that is religion and culture.
Let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina for our next call. Jenny is on the line. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Go ahead, please.
Well, I wanted to ask you about your discussion of a new fear.
Right.
And the reason that I am asking this is only because here as an American, I obviously see on TV and the papers that I believe the Bush administration and other things in America is really working off a fear culture. They're building, you know, the American people to be afraid of so many things, and they're easier to control. But don't you think this is actually something that it's in human nature to use fear to control people? I mean, just how Hitler has done, and historically through even Africa and other countries, that it's not necessarily a new fear.
It might be new to us, but it's not a new idea. Is that what you're saying, Jenny?
And that now that we are such a global economy and there's so much media coverage, now we're aware of it again. But, you know, is it something you really think it's a new fear, or it's just surfaced all over now? It's not, you know, just one area where people are being controlled by fear, but even America, supposedly the greatest country in the world, is also being controlled by fear of anything different than the American culture.
Well, I wouldn't say that fear is the only human emotion that is used to control society and human beings. You can also use greed. You can use competitiveness, which, of course, goes with the dissemination of goods, sometimes very useless goods, which then make entire peoples and cultures completely dependent on the supplier, on the supplying nation. And that is used very successfully also by the United States in its relations to the rest of the world, and even internally. You can actually create a slave community to share consumption. So I don't want us to focus only on fear when we're talking about control. There are numbers of other ways in which you control a people.
But it's one that I want to work with just for the purposes of this conversation, because you've named your book Climate of Fear. I want you to, if you can, explain to Jenny, you still there with us?
Absolutely.
What you're saying when it means when you identify climate of fear, then, if it's not new, or what is it?
Okay, let's go back a little bit. Let's go back to when the atom bomb, the fear of the atom bomb, virtually controlled the world. Because the very existence of the atom bomb and the possibility that it could be used at any time, unleashed on humanity. Try and recollect, for instance, the face-off between Cuba and the Kennedy administration. Now, that was a very real, palpable climate of fear. But it's a different one from the current one, which is one of not knowing from which direction and in what form one's security can be eroded. The face of the terrorist is, in fact, distinguished by its very facelessness. You knew who Khrushchev was, you knew who Kennedy was, you knew who Fidel Castro was. There were certain distinct lines of possible negotiation. And, of course, negotiation was what ended that particular period. But that's only one isolated instance of the use of the atom bomb as an instrument of fear. Before that, and including this particular episode, the very existence of the atom bomb and the Cold War created a climate of fear, very, very different from what we're undergoing today. Are you in Madrid? Are you in London? Are you in Kenya? Are you in Tanzania? This new fear is one which dominates all those various areas and many more that I've just quoted.
What do you think, Jenny?
Oh, I'm glad he brought that up, the idea of a faceless fear, because I think that is very powerful, especially here in the United States, where we live such a comfortable life and an idea of security that, you know, we could never be touched. And I agree that, and I think that fear is played upon quite a bit here in the United States.
Jenny, I thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
My name is Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Mr. Soyinka, you said at one point, and I can't remember where I read this, it might have been in another a newspaper article that I read, that you spend about a third of your time in Nigeria and a third of your time in an airplane and a third of your time here in this country. Is that fairly accurate?
Fairly accurate. A third in this country and in Europe and other parts of Africa.
So you will know the code words that came out in the early days of, you know, duct tape and orange and amber alerts and is that an appropriate response to the kind of fear that you're describing?
Yes. We're talking about practical policies. I want to, and one part of Jenny's question, the last speaker, we didn't touch on, was in fact the accentuation of an existing level of fear. And I think that is happening also here. Whether deliberately or not, I'm not going to pass judgment in this brief conversation. I have my own ideas about that. An accentuation of the existing level of fear is being done by the policies, internal policies of the United States, by these expressions of orange, yellow, amber, and so on and so forth. It's almost as if somebody somewhere is sitting down manipulating these various buttons, which are related to the visceral responses of the American population. The Patriot Act, for instance, said a number of aspects of the Patriot Act strike me as an extension of that, that climate of fear, an extension of it with some element of political opportunism to control the population of this country through policies of that nature. Now, the causes of fear are real. Please don't misunderstand me. Mm-hmm. A nation must look to its security, any nation, whether it's mine or yours. But certain aspects of policy responses strike me as being opportunistic politically.
Let's use that as a question for our own listeners. And a reminder that our number is 1-800-423-8255. Do you see this climate of fear at work in this country? Do you see it as more in America than it ever has been in our own recent history? And how much of it is real? How much of it is turned to some kind of political gain? And when we get into the latter part of the program, we need to talk a little bit more about what needs to change. So the climate of fear, or the people who would visit that upon people in all different continents of the world, somehow get some kind of coordinated response. What would that be? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You're listening to The Connection. My name is Dick Gordon. In the words of my guest, Wole Soyinka, some words are coarse, obscene, indecent. They make a case for censorship, such words as pagan, heathen, infidel, unbeliever, kafiri, etc. The cleric swears he'll sweep the streets clean of the unclean, armed with book and beard. Both turn kindling, but overturn the law of physics, for the fire consumes all but the arsonist. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking this hour about some of the ideas presented in Climate of Fear, the quest for dignity in a dehumanized world. Wole Soyinka is my guest, and we're going next to Cambridge, and Alan's joining us on the line. Hi, Alan.
Yes, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Good. My question for Mr. Soyinka, looking forward to reading his book. But he seems to indict religious leaders being the most feared as far as implacable negotiating partners. But I think the worst are the secular. You look at the worst of the Chinese government. You look at Joseph Stalin, killed 20 million Ukrainians. Saddam Hussein massacred hundreds of thousands of Shia. And Adolf Hitler rarely invoked God in his speeches. These were all the worst murderers of the 20th century. And they were not using religion. So I think that it's the human nature to be dastardly and implacable, not just religion. And I ask you to answer how you distinguish the two.
Well, as I said earlier, the fanatic in the religion is really the worst. I mean, take the Pope, for instance. The Pope has met people of all religions. Each time he travels, he even came to Nigeria, and he met people of different religions. So when we talk about leadership, it's not usually at that level. Ayatollah Khomeini, who comes from the very nation that sentenced a writer in absentia, Salman Rushdie, to death, he came to the United Nations and made a most enlightened speech in his address on the dialogue of nations. And he's been working with UNESCO to try and diffuse the extreme consequences of religious fanaticism, get civilizations to come together. So leadership cuts across different kinds of leaders and at what periods. The point I'm trying to make is this, that you can argue, you can talk to secular ideologues. You can hardly ever successfully argue with the theocratic ideologues. It's a very difficult thing. There are exceptions, of course, just as there are exceptions on the other side. But when you look at the broad picture of the possibility of communication, of dialogue, it's possible to talk to somebody who speaks from a secular basis than from a totally committed religious standpoint. Because religion does not take its authority from the material world that you and I know, but takes it from somewhere else in the stratosphere where people like you and I hardly ever venture. You understand the difference?
What do you think, Alan?
I kind of understand the difference, but I find it hard to figure how the oppressed Shia of Iraq were able to negotiate and talk to Saddam Hussein when he's burying hundreds of thousands of them in mass graves. He wasn't willing to listen. Secular, autocrats, I think, may be even more inflexible than a religious autocrat. I think maybe the mullahs of Iran are easier to negotiate with than perhaps Saddam Hussein type.
You remember Saddam Hussein deliberately exploited religious sentiments, set one religious group against another, give the authority to the minority, and made sure the other side, the majority, was actually repressed. Because he understood very well that when it came to religious solidarity, there could be no discussion at the time. So he exploited a religious situation, and that is what I'm talking about.
There's a distinction that you make in the book, and I'm not sure if I've got it right, but I want to test it with you. That's secular fanatics would say, I am right, you are wrong, and religious fanatics would say,
I'm wrong, you're dead.
I am right, you are dead.
I beg your pardon, I'm right, you're dead, yes.
Is that the difference, though? It's just, there is no conversation?
I'm afraid the kind of fanatics that we talk about from the religious side, they just do not stop to argue, to discuss. I'm right, you're dead. That is their philosophy. And it's been manifested every day.
Let's go to Concord, Massachusetts, and Sam's with us. Hi, Sam.
Hi. Yes, just a statement, and I think that part of it is the fact that a U.S. Reaction is due to their insulation or isolation from what's been happening all over the globe and for decades. Whenever there's a powerful ideology or reason, power struggle, all restraints are off. I mean, look at the example of the air in World War II, the fight against Nazism justified the deliberate targeting by widespread bombing and killing of German civilians by the hundreds of thousands. The atom bomb, the use of the atom bomb in Japan, which is the most indiscriminate weapon yet devised, was used because there was an overarching reason to win a war, to defeat Japan. So there's always a reason. Collateral damage is used as a euphemism to justify the killing of thousands of people in Iraq and elsewhere, not by individual terrorists, but by legitimate governments, democratic governments, dictatorial governments. So I think this unleashing, this trying to pinpoint just the religious fanatic, I think it's in a world that the United States has to realize it has to live in. There is no absolute security.
And maybe those states can be or can be seen to be as bad as the quasi-state actors that we're talking
certainly
about.
Certainly in terms of the quantity of innocent human beings destroyed, I mean, there's nothing to compare with the use of state violence.
Think about it. You know, power grows from the barrel of a gun. All those rhetorical excuses for all that death.
As we go back through history, I mean, take for instance, just as Germans unleashed a new wave of indiscriminate bombing, and the British also, you know, leveled Dresden and one or two other cities, I can't remember now, during the war. It's exactly the same principle of the extension of the power consequences. Okay, you have the power, so you use it. America went to Afghanistan in self-defense. I always say, once Al-Qaeda was located in Afghanistan, Americans had to do what they considered necessary to protect themselves against another September 11. But then that sense of power pushed America further and further and into Iraq. So you're absolutely right. There is also a certain stage when we're obliged to talk about state terrorism, even though it might, the actual military exercise might have started from a genuine or justifiable act of self-defense. But the existence of that power, the accumulation of that machinery of war, which must be tested sooner or later to shock and awe, then goes on and on until the original cause is lost. The amount of sympathy, for instance, which welled up all around the world after the unjustifiable atrocity of September 11, evaporated as a result of excess, the excess which was manifested in Iraq. And it all has to do, as you said very rightly, has to do with the existence of that machinery of power, which then tends to intimidate and dominate.
So if we just set aside argument or debate about definitions, state, non-state, secular, religious, self-defense, offense, we still come back to what we're talking about, a new kind of fear in the world. What's the fix? I know there's obviously not something simple here, but where do you turn for a way of somehow answering all that fear that is broad as a result of these different things we've been discussing?
In terms of a general answer, I find that virtually impossible. In terms of specifics, how do you eliminate, for instance, the fear which owes its cause to religious alliances across the globe? Then you isolate, or at least you identify, what region is really uniting certain parts of the world against the rest. And as I mentioned in my book, the Middle East was and may still be one of the primary causes. The sense of the Arab world, of the partiality of the rest of the world in the contest between Israel and Palestine. And the Arab world saw this as an assault on Arab culture, Arab society. As I say in the book, there is a community with a capital C which actually transcends national boundaries. And when a member of that community is seen to be ill-used, the rest come in a very instinctive and you could even say not particularly sophisticated way. They come instinctively to the side of the injured member of that society. If you remove that sense of injury in that particular spot, you do not thereby stop terrorism, but you reduce drastically the army of recruits. In other words, you've removed a cause which make so many young men mindlessly, and women sometimes mindlessly, go to the rescue of the injured member of society. Remove that cause and you've lessened the climate of fear that emanates from that particular larger community. And you do the same thing for other parts of the world which exist under a sense of collective injury. Collective injury, you can say it's not rational, you can say the response is primitive, is crude, is undialectical or whatever, but the fact is it is there. You remove the cause, you at least reduce drastically the tension that is created by fear for that particular cause.
You're listening to The Connection. My name's Dick Gordon. Are you saying that people in this country never really fixed on just exactly how much the Arab-Israeli conflict emphasizes that?
I'm afraid they did not. They did not. They underestimated, grossly underestimated, the instinctive response of that larger community to which I refer.
But let's talk about today. I'm an optimist and I'm a reporter, and I've spent too many times saying, you know, in 1993, maybe this is the turning point and maybe this is the turning point. But let's talk about, you know, new word of political reforms in Egypt, the fall of a puppet government in Lebanon, the Syrians confused about what their place in the Middle East is, and the Israeli government pulling settlers out of areas that are particularly volatile in that conflict. Are you willing to go to go so far as to say, hey, maybe something is changing now?
I would even go so far as to add to that list, of course, which is not exhaustive, I know, Darfur, the fact that the United Nations belatedly agrees to send a sizable number of observers or peacekeepers into Darfur and a few other instances. Yes, it's a very good question and one which I've asked myself over the past few days. That famous expression, cautious optimism, I think fits the bill in this instance. It's rather like the beginning of the dismantling of the communist empire. Perestroika, glasnost, we all responded very cautiously, but we got a whiff of a new breath of air being blown across that area. You had a feeling that you were witnessing the beginning of what you might say culminated as the fall of the Berlin Wall. And the signs were there much earlier, in fact, before perestroika became, or glasnost became a global word. If you visited the Soviet Union at the time, which you might have done, it was already there. It was there before it was really enunciated. And it could be that we're witnessing something similar. I sincerely hope so, but believe me, I'm very, very cautious.
The thing that I recall about the falling of the Berlin Wall and the unraveling of the Soviet Union was that once it began, there was a certain inevitability about it. Once, you know, protesters were allowed into the square in Vilnius and in Tbilisi, then you weren't going to tell protesters in the square in Kiev that they couldn't do the same kind of thing. And I'm curious to know if you think that there is some, we talked about lines earlier in the program, there is some line that needs to be crossed for this to take on the kind of inevitability that we'd all like to see.
Yeah, I would like to see, for instance, the religious body to which characters, so-called liberationists like Basayev belong, to be subjected to a pronouncement of the same kind of universal fatwa that was directed at the writer Salman Rushdie. I don't say a killing fatwa, as I emphasize in my book, but a kind of excommunication. That'll set a very strong example. That'll be a strong message being delivered to those who cross certain lines. And it would be a beginning. I agree with you absolutely. But you need a collective and very powerful response, a statement in that direction. Now, if that is added to what we begin to see as the dismantling of a certain form of autocracy, which is very germane to the kind of to the area, geographical area, the Islamic world that we're talking about, where authoritarianism has, you know, survived despite of the modernism, global modernism, you might actually see an extension of this crack in what I call the monolithic mentality that takes on both culture and religion into a very hardline oppositional view to other religions and cultures of the world.
You've seen a lot more of this than I have. Are you more cautious or are you more optimistic?
You're trying to pin me down to percentages here. And no, remember that even after this opening out began in the Soviet Union, after the first, my memory is beginning to play me false now, after the first concession in one of the satellite nations, the Soviet Union then suddenly, you know, reacted in the opposite way.
It
and
tried.
Crushed Hungary, went to Hungary, and crushed that uprising, even after it seemed to have allowed it in Yugoslavia. So we have, that is why I find it very difficult to come down very firmly.
All right, we'll talk about again. Mr. Shoyenko, thank you so much for being with us on the program today.
You're welcome.
Willy Shoyenko is winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1986, author of a new book called Climate of Fear. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.